Well, it depends on the situation again, because it's too vague. Sometimes mending means making payment arrangements and finishing paying. Sometimes it means doing an action on a repeated basis. Like I've had people asked by relatives to just call me once a month, right? So it can be sometimes an ongoing thing, and sometimes the situation warrants that because the person, for whatever reason, I think that I would, there'd have to be, I don't know that there's a cut and dry way to do any of these. And I think that you see as you read through this, they give you just examples of different amends that become more ideas or suggestions. And again, ultimately, we pray into them. So I'm not trying to be vague. I just don't know how to be more specific.
My understanding, when people said that you never finish your amends, I thought they were referring to people that, you know, you're unable to reach or contact, or that you've made contact, but they don't necessarily want to meet with you, or they just never reply. What is your opinion on those kind of amends?
On the people that you don't want you to contact them, or you can't find, or that you...
Or they're just uninterested.
Or just uninterested.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think the key here is that I'm willing to do it. If someone doesn't want anything to do with you, you got to respect that, right? To push yourself on someone that wants nothing to do with you could cause more harm.
Would a letter be appropriate at that time?
Not if they say leave them alone, right? Isn't that still forcing yourself on them?
What if you've received an amend from somebody in the program that wasn't even sincere? They were just doing it.
An insincere amend?
Yeah, they were just doing it so they could feel better about themselves.
Receiving an amends just so somebody could feel better about themselves, that isn't, you don't really perceive as an amends. You know, I talked about eliminating the goofy amends, right? That would be between... I think that there's a certain responsibility for a sponsor to sit with the sponsee and to listen to what's going to be done here, because you're dealing with someone that isn't familiar with making amends, and hopefully the sponsor has had experience with making amends, right, and knows what to listen for, and hopefully will continue to bring God into the situation and prayer into the situation to get clear on that. You know, I have an Asian sponsee. And someone in the program came to him to make amends to him. And she made amends to him for acting like she liked him, which she really didn't.
Oh.
I know, ouch. I mean, that was real hurtful to this particular person, because he's won't go into that. But the other thing that I want to bring up, there's somebody else got up at the podium, and she was so happy that she finally, after not seeing her father for many, many years, when she heard he was dying, she went to the hospital and to make amends to him. And what she did was she went and she told him all the things that he did to hurt her throughout her lifetime. And she was so happy because she said he just smiled, closed his eyes, and died. And she was so proud of that. And I was thinking, God, you know, he was probably glad because it was finally being able to get away. He couldn't get out of bed. He was stuck there until, you know, so he had to die. Anyway, you know, in the back there.
What I've said, it's a long one. Can you comment on praying for a short listing?
Praying for a shorter list of resentments? Some.
As you said, there's some redundancy there, right?
Yeah. All right. That's going back to the four-step, praying about shortening a long list of resentments. Someone called me up. They wanted me to listen to their fifth step. And we're talking, and I don't listen to fifth steps from people that don't write inventory the way I write inventory. Just my thing. And I asked him, so how many names do you have in the first column? He said, 2,000. And he hasn't finished the inventory yet. And he hadn't really gotten too far through it. He just kind of wanted some help through it. And I says, if you want my help through it, we're going to have to talk about shortening this thing. He had every politician, more politicians than I even knew existed, on his list. You know, he had the armed services. He wanted to be an actor. He had all the actors that he resented because they were successful, and he couldn't break into the industry. But he had them all listed separately. And I said, no, take all the actors and say performers that became successful in the industry. Just group them all together. You know, write one page and list all their names in the first column if you want. But it's all the same thing. Right? And I went through some of that stuff with him, and he got angry with me and hung up. He says, where's God in this? You know, and I don't, you know. I was minimizing his victimization of that he was suffering from the world. And it's like, okay, you know, what's the value of you holding on to all of this, right? And he, as far as I know, he never finished an inventory. Ever. So he would have been better off to write on 30 of them just to see how it worked. And then go back to the list and 30 or 50 of them just to see how it worked, and then go back and see, what am I really angry at now? Welcome back. Somebody humming that cheer song? All right, so 10 and 11. It's not uncommon for me to talk about things that are different than what a lot of people, what some people, how some people approach things in the steps. And the 10th step is another one of those places. I'm going to talk about some things that don't include writing inventory. It says that this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory. And I look at it, personal inventory is like a fourth step without a first column, right? Because it's no longer about them, right? It's no longer about, it's more about me being awake to my own behavior. Now, I talked about the maintenance and growth that it talks about in the fourth step, and it refers to it differently in here, where it talks about to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Right. Anyway, I'll get back to reading that in a minute. I think that a lot of what I hear in the program has more to do with seeking comfort than seeking God. Right? I'm pissed off at somebody, so I'm going to write inventory so I can get comfortable. Right? They spent a long time through the process here in the book discouraging me or helping me see that what I need is reliance on God. Yet, in the 10th step, what you see is more human reliance than in any other step, right? I'm supposed to call my sponsor with everything, right? And the problem with that is that it's so easy to develop a reliance on another human being. Yeah. Now, I know that it's stepping on some toes when I talk about this stuff, and I know that it's common, and I'm not saying, and I think it's really important to have a relationship with someone and to build that relationship of trust, right? But I also believe that we have to, that how we respond to a 10 step can be really helpful, right? And by talking about how to respond to a 10 step, we'll put more responsibility on the sponsee to do something before they even make the call, right? Which actually, in the long run, will make it easier on the sponsor, right? Because hopefully, what I'm encouraging here is not a dependence on me, but on a dependence on this power. When I'm working with people, you know, I work with a few people, and I certainly don't want to field phone calls from all of them every day. Right? I don't tell them to call me or not to call me. Right? They know that they can call me whenever they want, but it's usually with questions like how to work with somebody. You know, how do you respond to this? Right. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I listen to a 10-step and how I share a 10-step when I do. But I'm also going to put a twist to it. 10 and 11 are real similar to 6 and 7 from a certain perspective. And that is, in 6, remember, we looked at those questions. We looked back over the 6 steps, or the first 5 steps, and asked, can I see my behavior that was objectionable? Right? And am I willing to turn to God for help with that? That was 6 and 7. Seeing the behavior that we found objectionable and become willing to turn to God for all of those things. Right? We've gone through this process in 8 and 9. Usually when I start them with 10 and 11, they haven't finished that yet. But it's an exercise and an opportunity to access that power and direct and use that power in all these difficult situations. So now we're getting into step 10. And just like I separate 6 and 7, like define 6 and 7 like that, I draw a line through 10 and 11. And I look at 10 as what I do in my interaction with you, right? And 11 is what I do with my interaction with God and my relationship with God. And so you could also say 10 is about my relationship with you, and 11 is my relationship with God, right? And that's how I separate the two. So even though it talks about God in the 10th step, it's going to be about me remembering that I need to turn to God, about remembering that commitment to the relationship. All right, so now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. I read that already. Okay. We have a list of persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. You know what? I'm sorry. My page flipped over. I have this book that I normally use that is so well used that when you open it to a page, it just stays there. And I'm trying to break in this new book, but it's constantly throwing me into, constantly flipping back over the pages. Something didn't sound right. I just didn't quite catch it right away. Okay, step 10. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So what would vigorously commencing this way of living look like? Right? Right? I think that any spiritual path that you go on is going to have some kind of mindfulness practice attached to it. Right? And this is no different. But in order to stay awake and do what it says here, right, I have to make this commitment to it. And as we go, we're going to be making mistakes, and we're probably going to have more harms that we create, and we're going to continue to clean up the past. So as we're finishing the ninth step, we're probably going to be creating some new harms. but we just keep on taking it through the process. We have entered the world of the Spirit, right? And that's, for me, that place inside of me, right? And there's another way to look at that. And some people look at the fact that we've entered the world of the Spirit, meaning we've entered a world where, with a reliance on God rather than a reliance on people, or rather than a reliance on ourselves. You had a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Page 84.
Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Second indented paragraph. So you hear a lot of people talk about 10 and 11 as maintenance steps. But here's what it says, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Right? Again, maintenance is just about seeking comfort. And that's the way it's usually approached. But what does growing in understanding and effectiveness mean? Right? I have to keep watching for what that means, because that's going to change. And we're going to talk about that as well, especially when we get into 11. It says, this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. So, typically what you hear is, and again, even people in my home group write inventory and share it with sponsors, you know. So I even step on toes of people that see me on a regular basis. So, and I know that there's people here that I'm probably stepped on their toes by talking about this way. But it's just a different perspective that I want to share. And that's, but it says here that we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It doesn't say we continue to write about selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Right? Because if I'm being mindful as I go through the day and watching my behavior, right, I keep bringing that word up, right, watching, you know, seeing our behavior that we find objectionable, right? And when these crop up, not if they crop up, but when they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Right? So, how fast does it take a resentment to separate you from a good place? It's at once, right?
Vigorously.
It's at once, vigorously. Right. You know, I get separated at once. Right? Here it says, we watch for these things to crop up and at once turn to God to remove them. Not to remove the people, but to remove the resentment. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Right? So where's your sponsor going to be in the context of immediately? Right? Sponsor would be later, right? It doesn't say someone else. Right? Sometimes, I think that it means two different things here. I think that, yes, sometimes you're sharing it with somebody, like someone you trust, like a sponsor. But sometimes, in practice, that someone is the person that you're talking to, not someone else. They're the people that would be most productive to discuss this with. Right? Maybe something came out of your mouth that you realize, oh, I'm going the wrong direction here. Right? It would be a good place to be mindful of that. It'd be a good place to be mindful of that as it's happening, to watch for it to crop up, right? Ask God to help you with it, right? And then straighten out what you've done right away before the hole gets any deeper, hopefully. Right? It says we make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Quickly sometimes is immediately, right? So the focus here for me, and the practice of my focus here, is not to just go through the day screwing up and just dealing with it later, but to watch for the issues to come up, watch for that behavior to come up, turn to God at once, right, and straighten it out. To do your damage control right away before it gets any worse. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. See, the person you're going to probably need love and tolerance for is the person that you're holding back from, that you've just possibly harmed, right? They are possibly the one that you should turn your thoughts to, that you can help, right? So, again, I just want to say this, that it's not always... I said, ideally, we do it immediately. It's not always what happens, right? But if we try to do it immediately, we try to live this way, right? You start to watch for the opportunities, I call them opportunities, but situations that you need to turn to God for help with, to go in, consider why it's affecting you, to take your personal inventory. You know, why did this ruffle my feathers? Right? Ask God to show you what He would have you be with this person, start watching for that stuff instead of waiting for it. Right? When it slips out, see if you can straighten it out right away. That I believe can be a little harder. But anybody that's done this a while finds that they're probably doing that anyway. But I believe that to stress that part of it is important, because, again, where does the trust come from me to live a life based on a God reliance, right? But what could be better than to constantly watch for situations where I fall short, to turn to God at once to help me, and to see that it works, right? That's where the growth comes in, right? That's where because they're not talking about just personal growth. They're talking about spiritual growth, and spiritual growth to me is being me being able to more and more effectively turn to God for help at a good or improving level all the time. It says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. And if tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. Remember back in page 24, where it said, where it talked about insanity as being like touching a hot stove? Like with alcohol, I burned myself over and over. Here it's talking about recoiling from it, from a hot flame, as from a hot flame, because we react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. Right? I didn't fix myself, right? But I've been changed. The process has changed me. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Right? It just comes. And that is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. So, the problem with alcohol has been removed, but my alcoholism hasn't. Right? It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Does everyone know what a laurel is? It's like the feathered wreath that they put around a horse that's won a race. Right? We can get so spiritually intoxicated that we kind of can fall into that trap. Right? Look how spiritual I've become, and look how much I know about this stuff, and look how many people I sponsor, look at this, look at that, and it's like, you know. And all of a sudden you find yourself back going through, taking a newcomer through the book, and you're starting back at the circle and triangle on page one, and you're talking about being in balance between your mind, body, and spirit in that circle and triangle, you know, and asking those questions is, where are you at with your meetings? Where are you at in your recovery process? And where are you at with working with others? And you see that somehow I'm no longer quite in the center of that triangle, and I'm veering off to one direction or another, no longer centered in my own spiritual path, because I get so full of myself that my ego rebuilds itself, and I sometimes can't even see it. It's resting on my laurels, saying, you know, I've got everything I need to get from AA, so I don't need to work any harder. Or to say that this is as much as I can grow. This is as much as I can get from this program. I've already got it all. You know, my own experience has been, I must have gone through the step process a dozen times, right? And some people think, well, why would you want to? Right? My perspective is, why wouldn't you? Right? If you haven't tried it, try it. Right? I've worked with plenty of people that have gone through the steps with other people and never actually went through the book or have it explained this way. I have friends that like going through with different people every time they go through. You know, mix it up a little bit, keep it interesting, hear different perspectives. You know, we have people in my group are familiar with a term called step guide, where you keep your sponsor, but you have go through the steps with various people. Just to get it, just to mix it up a little bit, keep it interesting. Right? You know, where else can growth come from, right? Unless I have an open mind that maybe there's more for me. It says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. That can be confusing for some people because in the front of the book it says we recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? So in the beginning it says that we recover, and here in the end it says we're never cured of alcoholism. Right? I like to, again, we look at this as a threefold problem, right? Physically, I have the physical craving for alcohol. And as long as I never take a drink again, I'm never going to have that craving or the consequences of my drinking. And then there's the mental part. The mental insanity, the obsessions. The obsessions of alcohol, the obsessions to drink are different than the thinking of drinking. A lot of times you hear someone say, I'm thinking of drinking. Or they'll call you up and say, I'm thinking of drinking. Right? And its truth is that they're thinking they're not drinking, of not drinking. That's why they're calling you, because if they had the obsession, right, they wouldn't be calling you. Right? And it says that we recover from that. That there is a process to take you to a place where you couldn't drink even if you wanted to, right? Because from a spiritual place, from a fit spiritual condition, I couldn't take a drink. But it says here that we're never cured of alcoholism, and I believe that that's the spiritual side of the problem, right? That there's a condition that I don't think anybody, not alcoholics and not non-alcoholics, can escape from, and that's this yearning for something more spiritually. Right? The spiritual side of my alcoholism doesn't get, I don't recover from that. It just gets suppressed, right? And I have to acknowledge that because. What it follows up with is what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. A daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So That means it doesn't matter what we've done in the past spiritually. And it doesn't matter what we plan to do in the future. Right? What we're looking at here in the 10th step is, what am I willing to do today to maintain and grow a spiritual way of life? Right? And every day is going to bring about different challenges and what that's going to look like. It says, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Not just in the morning, not just at night, but into all of our activities. Right? That becomes my practice. Watching for opportunities, watching for behavior that I find objectionable, and practicing turning to God for help with that. And it's through that practice, it's through that seeing varied situations over and over again, and how easily those situations are solved by a simple reliance on God. All right, with all I know, I have to say I don't do it perfectly, and sometimes I'm really bad at it. All right, again, I'm just human. All right, but I've had enough experiences to know that it really works. Right, and it's a practice, and I try to practice my practice. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Right? You've heard all kinds of things like, you can't trust your alcoholic mind. You can't. We talk about stinking thinking and talking like we're never going to live up to what a normal person could live up to because we've got a damaged mind. And I don't buy that. I think some of the people around here are much sharper than a lot of people that I've seen outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we have strong wills, just not when it comes to not drinking on our own power. And I think that what it's talking about here for me is just to align that will with God's will. You know, because along with what I'm capable of and along with what God's capable of through me, right, it's just an awesome team. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. See, I've always believed completely in what I could see or taste or hear, or you know, all my physical senses I trusted completely. Yeah, but where did that get me? Right? Because even though I see situations, my inventory showed me that I didn't necessarily perceive them how I see them now after writing an inventory. Right? I saw that I can't necessarily trust my physical senses. Even my mind, sometimes, you know, from an insane place, it was completely rational to say I don't want to drink again, but I drank anyway. And then in sobriety and from a spiritual place, being frustrated with something and saying a drink would fix it, knowing that that's not true and knowing that I couldn't drink anyway. Right. What they're talking about here is starting to develop a reliance on a sixth sense. And it's something that I've always ignored. And it's not something that I can reason. It's something that I have to live. And it's through living it that I build more trust with it by seeing it work. Typically what happens is I'll go through the section, step 10, with someone I'm working with, and I send them home with a practice for a week. I say, okay, I want you to practice being mindful, watching the situations that your interactions, right, and practice bringing God, turning to God in those situations, right? You know, you say you're on a spiritual path, start living like it, right? Start living like it. I don't give them a lot of complicated things to look at. Just watch your behavior, right? And practice bringing God into your interactions, right? And do that for a week. And then when we get together again, we go through step 11 the following week. And I try to break it up so that they see some separation in between the two. Because it's so easy to go, I'm in 10 and 11. Right? Just like I'm in 8 and 9. It's like they could have made them one step almost, the way we sometimes think about them. So sometimes breaking them up like this will just help someone get a deeper understanding of the different parts of this. So step 11 is at the bottom of page 85. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. Now you'll hear all kinds of different definitions of prayer and meditation. Certainly I have mine. But you always have to look at the context that something's used in to know which definition is correct. And if you look up the word prayer in a big dictionary, I think I have 3 pages of prayer in a 6-inch thick dictionary. So you have to go back to the context that it's used in. And I believe that the context it's used in here is prayer means we ask God. And meditation doesn't necessarily mean silence. But I know if it's an 11-step meeting or 11-step topic, you'll get people talking about how long they sit in meditation or what they or the Buddhist path or whatever they're into. I said, and I tell people, don't let your silent meditation get in the way of your 11th step. You know, because meditation just means directed thought. Right? If it's silent meditation, we're directing our thoughts to silence. Right? But what it's doing, it's not going to talk about a silent meditation here. It's going to talk about a contemplative meditation where we're directing our thoughts to a particular ideas. It says we shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Now, I always read that as shy being like afraid to show you that I'm praying. But shy also means short, like 11 is one short of a dozen. Right? And I think that fits better with the context for me. Although I have had people argue that, but I'm sticking to what I like. So we shouldn't be short on this matter of prayer. Better men than me are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. Right? There is some responsibility that I have to take to be on a spiritual path. I'm going to have to work at it. I just have to understand what I can work on and what I can't work on. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Right? So they're not going to be vague here. They're going to give us some definite and valuable suggestions. So you're not going to have to look anywhere else but right here for what the 11th step is supposed to look like. So it says, when we retire at night, we constructively, not destructively, but constructively review our day. Where were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Now, that sounds a lot like another inventory, doesn't it? So what's the difference between continuing to take personal inventory in the 10th step and asking where was I resentful, selfish, or dishonest, or afraid in the 11th step? Some people will think, well, just Bill was redundant. And I don't think that was true. I think the difference is in the explanation in the text where it says in the 10th step, we watch for those things to crop up right? While I'm interacting in a relationship with you people. And in the 11th step, it's about a contemplative meditation between me and God. And if I'm going to write inventory, it's usually after the fact. And if you're writing inventory for a 10th step, I wonder if it should really be called an 11th step inventory. Right? Again, I piss people off by talking about that too, because we're so used to just calling it a 10th step. Right? And I'm just saying that it seems to me that it would fit more into context here by calling that inventory an 11th step.
I think the confusion there lies in it talks about doing an inventory at step 10 and the 12 and 12. I think that's
the what? I'm just joking.
No,
you said the 12 and 12.
That's
is it the one?
The misunderstanding comes from. And I think that Bill Wilson was kind of confusing that way. He said one thing in the big book, and 10 years later he said something else.
Well, you have to remember that the I don't want to beat up on the 12 and 12 because it certainly has its value. But those were essays in the grapevine. And they weren't originally, yes, they were essays in the grapevine that were pulled into a book. So for it to be a story or an essay for 1 month, it lost, I think, some focus. And even Bill never suggested that was supposed to replace the big book for a step guide. So the fact that there's a lot of places that get contradicted in them. And I don't even find it helpful with the traditions. If you want a good book on the traditions, pick up Language of the Heart, also Bill's writing. Right? There's a section there on each 12 step in order doesn't have all the stories around it that Bill uses in the 12 and 12. And you'll understand it better out of the Language of the Heart than you might out of the 12 and 12. I did.
Yeah.
That was my experience. So, see, it's still sounding like an inventory here. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we should be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Now, I've been guilty of making these lists of things, these questions to answer at night, and to tediously look at each one of those questions and to see what applies to my day. But what I really found was that if you look at this whole thing, it's basically saying, how did you behave? How did you behave to the people with the people around you? You know, which is kind of consistent to what I've been talking about throughout the process here. Right? How did I behave? And when I started looking at it this way, the next sentence kind of it just hit me as what they were talking about with this next part here, where it says, after making more review, we ask God's forgiveness and require what corrective measures should be taken. I always thought, why am I asking God's forgiveness here for looking at my interactions with people? And I realized is that anything that comes up in this nightly review, when I retire at night, is going to be things that were a result of ignoring God. Right? What I'm reviewing here at night is how well did I 10th step? The 10th step is a mindfulness practice where I'm bringing God into all of my activities. And now I'm looking at where did I fall short. And here is the biggest place that growth can come from. Because now, just like 6 and 7, where I've reviewed all of this stuff from the past and I'm willing to turn to God for help with this, now I'm just looking at today. Where did I fall short? Right? And I become willing to turn to God for help with this tomorrow. Right? Because it says here, upon awakening, on awakening. I don't know why I keep saying upon, but I know it's on awakening. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. It says we consider our plans for the day. What that used to mean to me is I'd say, okay, I'm going to wake up at this time, and then I'm going to eat breakfast, take a shower, get to work, come home, get ready, go to a meeting, right? Well, a couple days of that, it got really boring, and it was like, how can I, you know? Right? And what occurred to me was is that this is a practice, and what I need to consider in my plans for the day is, at night, I looked at how well did I 10-step. I identify where I fall short, where I'm not bringing God into my life, and where it's causing problems. So when I consider my plans for the day, I look at what was it that came up in the review that I can bring in today to do better with today. Right? All right, I'm not nice to that person at the meeting because he's so annoying when he talks to you. So I do things so that he doesn't want to talk to me. Right. I see that's objectionable on a number of different levels, and it comes up in my nightly review. So when I consider my plans for the day, it's like, okay, today when I see him, I'm going to shake his hand. But going into it, I'm going to pray into it. Ask God to help me have the kindness and patience and tolerance that it's going to be necessary to have this interaction. All right? I have a brother in my life that's not doing well, and I hate hearing about, because he's sick. He's got hepatitis C and diabetes and some other stuff, and I don't want to hear how sick he is. I want to hear that he got up, took a walk, and he's on a diet and losing weight and feeling healthier than he's ever felt or in a long time at least. And I want to hear that he's doing well. I don't want to hear about the doctors again. I don't want to hear about the problem again. Right? So I find myself being impatient with him. Short with him. And in a nightly review, that's been coming up really more than pretty much anything. Because I talk to him every day. Right? And in the morning when I consider my plans for the day, you know, his name comes up a lot. So today when I talk to him, I'm going to pray into it and just ask God to give me the patience and tolerance to let him talk, because he's got no one else to talk to. You know, me and him are he's the closest person in the world to me, and I believe that that I'm the closest person in the world to him. And if you can't talk to the person who you perceive as the closest person in the world to you, who can you talk to? Right? So I find my own behavior more objectionable than his. And I don't want to be like that to somebody I love. Right? So spiritual growth comes for me in little pieces. Right? But I have to be mindful. I have to look for where is it that I need to be more mindful and to bring God into more of my life. It says, before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. Right? Now that sounds a lot like what it says here, where it says where the 11 steps suggest prayer and meditation. Right? Asking God to direct our thinking means the same as prayer and meditation. Especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or selfish motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance that after all, God gave us brains to use. Right? Another place in the book that doesn't say that we have damaged minds or that you can't trust your thinking. Right? When we live on along spiritual lines and we try to align ourselves with what God would have us be, we can definitely use our minds. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Let's see what's the timing here. It goes on to give us some stuff in the morning to do, and I don't want to just read this to you. I know that that can get a little dry. So I'm going to move to 87, to if circumstances warrant. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. I have, I know a lot of people that like doing 11th step considerations with their spouse or girlfriends. You know, and that can be a little scary initially, but the people that I know that do it swear by it. Right? It says, if we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. Underline also. It doesn't say instead. Right? It doesn't say to do that instead of this. Right? For somehow the 11 steps turned into a lot of different things in AA. Right? And none of it is really mentioned here, but it doesn't discourage it because there's a lot of good spiritual practices, and I would certainly encourage everyone to pursue their various options and see what sits right with them, right? But I believe that considering how I'm treating people and considering how I'm living and being mindful of and identifying where I need to be awake to the idea that I need to turn to God harder in certain areas, that's in addition to whatever else you're doing outside of AA. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about those may be obtained from one's priest, rabbi, priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they have, what they offer. Again, they are talking about this after 10 and 11. Right? And I believe that this practice will make anything else you do more meaningful, more powerful. Right? So, there's another meditation I'd like to share with you that I like to do at night in the nightly review. I told you that I keep going back to page 52, and we've done it in the first step, the second step, the third step, right? And I like to go back to it in the 11th step because sometimes mixing it up a little keeps it interesting and makes it easier to do things on a more regularly without getting bored. And the page 52 becomes a really useful meditation from the 11th step perspective. I like to ask, with the relationships, like, did I bring God into my relationships today? Did I remember to bring God into all of my relationships today? And I contemplate what that means, what relationships I'm looking at, love relationships, friends at the meetings, people at work. I look around my life and I ask, is there anywhere where I'm not bringing God into my relationship? In my emotional nature, right? Is there emotional things coming up where I'm forgetting to turn to God for help with that? Right, misery and depression, right? Fears, feelings of uselessness—all those things that it talks about on page 52. Right? It becomes a great meditation. It's where am I ignoring God? Right? Again, another. Tool to identify potential areas of growth, right? To areas where I can grow spiritually. So at the bottom of 87, I believe that that this whole thing has pretty much set me up to live this way. And as we talked about in the third step, it was a decision in the third step, but today it's the way I try to live. It says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves that we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decision. Right? It calls that a danger. Right? Why is that a danger? To be in, you know, excitement doesn't necessarily mean happy, because you could be overly excited about what somebody's doing in a negative fashion or a negative way. But fear and anger and worry, self-pity and foolish decision, why are those dangerous? It's because they separate me from a spiritual place. And why is that dangerous? It's because all I have is a spiritual reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. You know, well, what's wrong with that? It's because the spiritual malady returns, right? It sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return, the alcoholic insanity. Right? And that's what leads me towards the first drink. Right? And that's not just for newcomers. Right? You know, because you see people, you hear of people that drink with decades in sobriety, decades in the program. What changed? Right? The book tells me that something was wrong with my spiritual condition. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. Playing God was a tough job. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in this simple way we have just outlined, right? Being mindful of where I fall short, and practice turning to God for help with it, and checking how well I did that in the 11th step. When we've done all this work, we've spent all this time with it, and we should be feeling pretty good by the time we get to this point. But look what it says. But this is not all. There's action, more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. So, it was interesting about this term, this word, faith without works is dead. And that actually, a Bible thumper was actually someone who quoted this for me, and where that this is in the Bible. And I'm nowhere near, I've never even owned a Bible. So, if you have a problem with that, don't blame me. It's just, I thought that the definition was interesting, because the context it was that faith without works is dead was used in. And it has something to do with, you see someone who's hungry and you walk by them and you say, "Have a nice day," and don't help. Something along those lines. I'm sure there's somebody that could explain it much better than me, but I think in this context it means, okay, now I've got all of this stuff. I've got all of this information. I've changed my life, right? Now there's something to do with that. I've been given a gift, right? And now it's time to share it, right? Because to walk by somebody in a meeting, I mean, you have it easy now because, you know, newcomers come to meetings. You don't have to go try to help them in homeless shelters, although some people do. But you see people come into meetings that are new, and you can't, and a lot of people can't be bothered with them. You've got your friends, you've got your little clique. You know, you want to make sure you know where everybody's going to coffee afterwards or whatever, right? Right, and that becomes more important than that person who's there in their first meeting that doesn't know anybody and has no clue what this thing is all about. Right. So it's one thing to say, I got mine, right? But it's another thing to take what you got and do something with it and help others. So, which brings us to working with others. It seems like Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much started with working with others before it had any of this other stuff, or most of this other stuff, right? The basis of this was working with others, and it's turned into something different for a lot of people. Now, I'm not... I think that a lot of things that go along and around in Alcoholics Anonymous is good stuff. But it's too easy to not... It's too easy for people to not care about working with others. It's too easy to say, well, I don't know what to do with someone. Right? And I believe that we all have a responsibility for what alcoholics become in the future. You know, if we take responsibility for our own spiritual growth and to understand what this thing is teaching us, right, and understand that there's people here that really need help from people that understand how to go through the steps. You know, again, my initial experience with the program, with five sponsors, four of them had no clue what to do with me. Right? When I found the fifth, I stuck with him for the next 22 years. No, 20 years. He passed away in 2003. Right? And if the other people had something for me, I wouldn't have had a reason to need to change. And I got to say that working with others is the best part of this program. It's the best part of this. Right? Book says it's an experience you must not miss. Right? And I know that out of experience. When I came to this program initially, I had pretty much trashed my life. I had very little self-worth, very little value of who I thought I was. I felt like I was a failure in pretty much everything I had tried to do at that point. And, you know, when you start working with others and you see this transformation happen in their lives, you can't feel that. You can't feel worthless. You can't feel like you have no value. You can't feel like you have no purpose. You know, sure, sometimes those ideas come to me, like, you know, is this really that important? Right? But then you got that sponsee that as soon as they call you, you know, yes, it's worth it. You know, one of the things I like doing is taking newcomers hiking. One thing about newcomers is they like to talk a lot, right? And sometimes it's usually about themselves. And then you got the smart ones that will throw out a, how are you doing today? And then the next couple hours is about them. Yeah, they're trying, but just so consumed with themselves. Right? But you know, when you take them hiking, that only lasts for about 30 minutes, and then they're panting too much to keep talking usually. And I remember this one guy, he was so full of himself. He was 6 foot something, long blonde hair down to the middle of his back. He'd walk in the room and all the girls' eyes would just go right on him. Right? And his parents didn't want anything to do with him. Hadn't talked to them in years. And we'd go hiking like every other day. And there's a few stories I can go into, but I just want to stay on track here. Within about a year, he didn't have the time to go hiking every other day with me anymore because he had all these commitments with his family, right? Or he had to be there for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever it was, and he was going to stay there for a week. And it's like, you know, you don't always see the growth in yourself, but when you see people's lives be transformed, right? And, you know, they want to give you all the credit as their sponsor. And it's like, you know, what did I do? You know, I can't manage my own life. I certainly don't expect to manage yours, right? But you just take them down this path, the same path that you were on, and you can see their lives transform, and you see their families come together, and you can't deny the value that you have in the world when you see that happening around you. I think it's important to take some responsibility for what you're going to pass on, to learn more about it. It doesn't have to be my way. I don't think I have the only way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. It may not, you know, it doesn't work for it. I shouldn't say it doesn't work. It doesn't appeal to everybody. But I, you know, I believe that it's certainly perfect for me. I found my perfect path. And I just encourage you to find yours, even if it's not exactly what I'm saying. But get excited about the program and learn how to transmit the experience that you had and do that. Right? I think God is bigger than what we do out of the book. I think God is bigger than how many meetings you go to or who your sponsor is. You know, and some people do get it at a simpler level and some people can't. Right? But you cannot deny that me putting myself in a place to be of maximum service to God and the people around me has changed my life. And if you told me that that would be the best part of my life 23 years ago, I would have laughed at you. Didn't care a bit about other people. I was more concerned with what I didn't have and what I wasn't getting. Right. One of the things that I talk about when I get people to the 12th step is that it's sort of kind of a circular process here where, and I talked about it in the beginning, where 12 is back to back with 1. And you can go through working with others considering the questions is, can I see when I was new how I thought about this stuff as I go through the chapter of working with others? Relating my personal experience back then when I was new to what it's saying now. You know, and I can have an experience with this, a personal experience with working with others through this book. But a lot of what I hear is people's excuses for not wanting to work with people is, well, I forgot what my sponsor did with me in the beginning. Right? And that's the value I put on a lot of notes and a lot of instructions and a lot of I hate to use the word methods or methodology. No. I'm tired. Yeah. Mechanics. You know, but it becomes a great teaching tool. You just can't attach to the tool. Right? You know, you don't praise the hammer and chisel, you praise the sculpture. Right? The result of that. You know, I've heard people say it's like the painting of Michelangelo's painting of David, where he's pointing, was reaching out, pointing to God. He says, "Don't worship the finger. Worship what it's pointing to." The other thing I hear people say is, "Well, people don't ask me to sponsor them, right?" And they say, "Yeah, I give out my card at meetings." And well, think about it when you were new, right? You'd come home from your first meeting. How many cards did you have? Right? Did you know who any of them were? Sitting on your kitchen table with all these cards laid out. Right? Mine happens to have my picture on it, so I think I got a little advantage. But it's just a piece of paper to them. Sure, it's got your phone number, but what's really there to motivate them to contact you? I tell the people I work with, is sure, give them your business card, right? But take their number too. Take their card, right? When newcomers are told to do it, to take people's phone numbers, they don't like it, but they don't grumble about it. They say, okay. Right? They think it's they're keeping themselves sober with that, or ensuring their sobriety with that. You know what's a bigger insurance for sobriety? Is tell the people when they get in, your people you're working with, when they get into step 12, to go out and take 5 people's phone numbers a week and call them. Right? You want to hear grumbling? Then you hear grumbling. It's like almost like I'm above doing that, aren't I? Because think about who you would have been attracted to when you were new. Right? You start to see how your experience will benefit others when you start just thinking about your own experience. Because when you were new, the people that you were attracted to were the people that you thought cared even a little bit, that even gave you a little bit of time. You know, you don't have to, they don't have to all, everybody you call doesn't have to ask you to sponsor them, nor do you have to try to sponsor everybody you call. But you know, if somebody's brand new to the program, maybe it would be nice to find out if they had a car to get to another meeting. Maybe suggest meetings for them, right? You've taken their number. Why don't you say, look, I'll call you. We can go and have coffee on the way to the meeting. And bring the, take the, so we can drink some better coffee than this at the meeting. Right? And I'll pick you up. Or tell them to pick you up. Right? They like that. Right? Because they don't like to feel like they're a burden or like they're taking sometimes. And people tend to feel better about being in a place where they can offer something in exchange for your kindness. And imagine that. Someone being happy about picking you up just because you're nice to them. Right? You know why you stand out? It's because the rest of the people in the room didn't give that much energy out towards them. Right? When you start standing out to these people, they're going to start asking you questions about the program. And if you're someone that knows about the program and have the answers for them, and you make sense to them, right? Then you're going to start sponsoring people, right? And where does it start from? Just be nice. Just be friendly. Just be compassionate to the fact that they don't know anybody else in the room. I mean, they might not even like you, right? So to be all concerned with whether you have to talk to them or not may not necessarily have to be a big deal. Right, and they might even, you might put a little bit of energy out, and they might start telling you about the sponsor that they found that wasn't you. Right, don't be attached to that. Just try to be helpful. Right, and eventually, when you start to get a few people that you're working with, you start to smell like a sponsor, and I don't know why that is. Right? But you start working with people and people just seem to pick up that you're someone that works with people. right? So people are laughing because they kind of relate to that, right? And it's like, once you get a taste of it, what could be better than having a meeting with your sponsees in a room where you're in control of basically what the format is? You can tell them when to talk and when to stop. Right? It's the best meeting you could possibly have. And a workshop takes that up to another level because you're the facilitator and they're going to talk when you tell them to talk and about what you tell them to talk about. Right? I'm kind of joking about that, but it's also kind of true. Right? You know, there is deeper levels of this program than just meetings. Right? And participating in that part of the program changed my life. So our time is almost up, so I'm just going to end with the 12-step promises. Have you heard what the 12-step promises are? Yeah? Some people have. Most people haven't heard this. Okay, here's on page 97 is the 12-step promises. Oh, let's save that for next. There's another thing. You know what page the sex inventory is on, right?
69.
Page 69. Right? Did you ever read the instructions for dating in the program on page 96?
Oh, yes.
Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. All right. So here's the 12-step promises. Never avoid these responsibilities, but be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day, if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money or your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she's neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he's violent. Sometimes you will have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally you'll have to meet such conditions. Right? But I wouldn't miss it for the world. So thanks for having me come out here and sitting through all of this with me.